The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
This is the 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine.
KKFI listeners, this is Sandra Mead. Welcome to Trans Talk, this week's edition of the 10th Voice. Behind the board, Linda Wilson is on vacation this week, so we've got Mark Andres filling in. Mark, thank you very much for filling in for Linda. Very much appreciated.
My pleasure.
We have a really interesting show lined up with two great guests today. The first interview guest is going to be Claire Swinford. She's a gap advocate in the trans community. We talked to her about the undocumented trans immigrant population, their incarceration in America's detention facilities, and the difficult challenges they face. The second interview guest is going to be Eli Ehrlich. She's the executive director of Trans Student Equality Resources. We'll be discussing AB 1266, the School Opportunity and Success Act. That's a bill which helps ensure California students have access to the facilities and activities corresponding to their gender identity. A bill for AB 1266 was signed into law last year by Governor Jerry Brown. And there's currently a determined campaign by anti-transgender activists underway in California to put a stop to that bill. It went into effect on January 1st. And, of course, we're going to round out the show with a community calendar update, which was researched by Michael Popa. Michael's not going to be in the studio with us, but we've got the calendar to share with you. So first, let's get started with a breakdown of some of the LGBT news for this week. And starting out in Scotland, the Scottish Parliament announced Tuesday that it scheduled the final debate and vote on its same-sex marriage legislation for February 4th. The bill passed its initial debate and first reading last November by a 98-15 vote. Last week, the Scottish Parliament's Equal Opportunity Committee unanimously voted to pass an amendment removing the spousal veto from the bill, granting married transgender people legal recognition of their gender without being forced to obtain written consent from their spouse. A recent poll found a majority of Scotland's population, 56%, support the legislation and marriage rights for same-sex couples. In Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, two transgender women from Brazil were detained and their passports confiscated while on vacation in Dubai, and they have been charged with the crime of imitating women. The two hairdressers from Amazonas, Brazil, were detained in December while attending a local nightclub and are now awaiting trial with the possibility of further imprisonment, fines, and or deportation back to Brazil. The law prohibiting imitation of women by men punishes offenders with fines, deportation, and possible imprisonment of 6 months to a year. The pair's passports have been confiscated by the authorities, so they cannot leave the country. Brazil's embassy confirmed the case and said the pair will have to wait a court session to be held on March 23rd. A Hong Kong billionaire reportedly doubled down this week on his offer of a massive amount of money for any man who can win the heart of his lesbian daughter. Cecil Chow first made headlines in September 2012 when he announced the initial offer of $65 million after his daughter, Gigi Chow, eloped with her female partner in France. Now Chow, who is upping the ante by offering approximately $130 million to any man who can sweep Chow off her feet after his first office offer, reportedly attracted 20,000 unsuccessful suitors. I don't think my dad's offering of any amount of money would be able to attract a man I would find attractive, Chow stated in an interview with the South China Morning Post. I would be happy to defriend any man willing to donate huge amounts of money to my charity, Faith and Love, provided they don't mind that I already have a wife. And in Topeka, Kansas, on Wednesday, a Kansas judge ruled that a man who provided sperm to a lesbian couple in response to an online ad is the father of a child born to one of the women and must pay child support. Topeka resident William Marotta had argued that he waived his parental rights and didn't intend to be a father. The Topeka Capital Journal reported Shawnee Mission County District Judge Mari Mativi rejected that claim, saying the parties didn't involve a licensed physician in the artificial insemination process, and thus Marotta didn't qualify as a sperm donor. The Kansas Department for Children and Families filed a case in October 2012 seeking to have Marotta declare the father of a child born to Jennifer Schreiner in 2009. The state was seeking to have Marotta declared the child's father so he can be held responsible for about $6,000 in public assistance that the state had provided, as well as future child support. And what a difference an election make, taking a look at Virginia. Gay marriage may soon have its first foothold in the South. Virginia's new attorney general said Thursday that he concluded the state's ban on same-sex union is unconstitutional. He will join the fight against it. Herring's announcement came less than 2 weeks after he started the job as part of a Democratic sweep of Virginia state legislature or leadership in the last November election. When Democrat Terry McAuliffe was elected governor and Herring as attorney general, Virginia made an abrupt turn away from the socially conservative office holders that they had succeeded, particularly Republican Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, an outspoken activist. We featured some of his comments here before, an outspoken advocate on social issues such as abortion and gay marriage. Herring stressed that the same-sex ban will be enforced despite his challenge while the case is working its way through the judicial process. And in Topeka, Kansas, Kansas Republicans who are alarmed at the wave of marriage equality victories around the country have introduced a new religious freedom bill called the Religious Freedom Act of 2014. According to Equality Kansas Executive Director Thomas Witt, HB 2453 allows anyone who objects to same-sex marriage to pretend that marriage doesn't exist. Even if the Kansas ban on same-sex marriage is declared unconstitutional by the courts, if this bill becomes law, it would allow county clerks to refuse to issue marriage licenses anyway based on their personal religious objections. It would allow state agencies to not recognize the marriages, and it would even allow for-profit Kansas companies to refuse to offer spousal benefits to spouses of same-sex married couples. This bill also says no fact-finding will be allowed in any case where gay and lesbian couples choose to sue to have their marriages recognized, and the couple would have to pay for court costs and attorney's fees of their party that they sued. There will be a hearing on this bill on Tuesday, January 28th at 9 a.m. For more information, go to KansasEqualityCoalition.org. And the last thing we've got in our news today is, according to the Gay Star News, an unnamed woman has reportedly disowned her cat for being gay in Nigeria. According to a reputable local media source, she said she would be giving away her pet of 7 years after she discovered it was showing unnatural sexual behavior. The cat named Bull was alleged to be in the habit of making sexual advances only to other male cats, even though there were female felines living in the same house. The Gay Star News admits that it could not confirm the authenticity of the story, but it reflects the current status of Nigerian society. They recently passed a very difficult and stringent jail all the gays bill there in Nigeria. And that's all I've got on the news. Stay tuned here in just a minute. We've got our first interview coming up. We're going to be discussing the immigration system. Basically what this story is all about, the immigration system is broken in the United States, and I think everybody knows that. I don't know that anybody would necessarily disagree with that. People on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, both want to have our immigration system reformed. They all agree on that. It's estimated right now that there are about 30,000 binational LGBT couples who are legally married in the United States. On the recent plus side, thanks to the Supreme Court overturning DOMA last year, all Americans can now apply to sponsor their foreign-born partners via spousal visa, regardless of gender. And that even applies to transgender people. However, what if the immigrant doesn't have a spouse to sponsor them? What if they are one of an estimated 15 to 50,000 undocumented transgender immigrants in this country, many of them with families having fled terrible conditions in their own homeland, unable to speak the language, and unable to get a job? How is that population treated by the American justice system if they are detained? We're going to explore this marginalized community and the situation they face with Claire Swinford. She's a well-known trans activist who specializes in getting her hands dirty, working on the ground level with the most marginalized segment of the trans community. We're really pleased to have Claire on the show with us today. She'll be on here in just a minute. She was chosen by the transgender community as part of the inaugural Trans 100 that was published last year. Claire, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Claire, our apologies for the delay in getting you on the line here. Thank you very much for joining. I gave our listeners a little bit of a background kind of on what the subject is going to be. The difficult situation transgender immigrants possibly face here in the country that I'm hoping you can share with us. Gave them a little bit of background about you. So I want to start out by saying thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to join us here on KKFI today.
Well, and I'd like to thank you for inviting me on today. This is a topic that I don't think we're really talking about enough, and maybe not talking about it enough in those forums where we can really have an honest conversation. This is a topic with a lot of rhetoric and not a lot of reality being presented in the media, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to that.
Absolutely. I think it's important. I'd imagine that we have very little data on that segment of the community. I know there was a report released in October by the National Center for Transgender Equality that shed some light on the undocumented transgender immigrant population and the pervasive discrimination they face. I'm having a hard time talking today. What can you tell us about the community and how and why they come here? And how do you get contacted? Claire, what is it that you do with them, and how do they reach out to you for assistance?
Okay, I'll take that point by point. And first, you are precisely correct. This is a very difficult community to capture data on. The transgender community is, of course, very much a shadowed community, but the undocumented immigrant community is also a very shadowed community. And when you combine those two, it becomes very, very difficult to come up with anything statistically useful. The NCTE report is actually very, very well done, and I hope everybody has a look at that because there's some really, really good stuff in there. Beyond that, most of what we do as far as data, previously the NCTE has released the National Trans Discrimination Study, which I think gives us a really, really good view of what oppression looks like in the transgender community. And then you can overlay that, some of the data that exists out there about the oppressions in the immigrant community. And the University of Arizona Latin American Studies Program recently released a report that does a wonderful, wonderful job of that. It's called In the Shadow of the Wall. And that dives pretty heavily into the experience of immigration and of migrants as it interfaces our immigration system, whether that's border patrol or detention or all points in between. It also sheds some light on some things that are happening well away from the border, like the Safe Communities Program, which is the federal program that effectively empowers local law enforcement to act as immigration officials.
Now, that didn't used to be the case, right? Isn't that something kind of recent that that local and state enforcement officers can now be employed in the immigration enforcement? Is that something new?
Relatively recent. That is one of the programs that actually kind of launched under the previous administration,
okay,
but has expanded under the Obama administration. And I do want to point that out there. I mentioned rhetoric, all of this talk about immigration reform, and at this point we're nearing 2 million deportations under Barack Obama's term. He actually has substantially more deportations than George W. Bush did. So right now there's a whole lot of talk, but the action is actually moving in the wrong direction of any talk you might hear coming out of Washington. And this report sheds a whole lot of light on that. There's also a wonderful, wonderful report out there from an organization called No Más Muertes, No More Deaths in English. And that report is going to go very, very deeply into what things look like actually on the ground here in the borderlands, the interactions with Border Patrol, the interactions with the smugglers, the coyotes, etc. And when you look at things like that and you overlay that over what we already know and the data we have with the transgender community, you begin to get an idea of what it looks like to face both of those oppressions at once. And really, that's some of the best data we have.
And how, do they contact you? Yeah, what is it that you do for the community, the undocumented immigrants?
I am working with an organization called Rainbow Defense Fund, and we are modeled after what are commonly referred to as mutual aid societies. And these are groups within the immigrant community that look out for one another, take care of one another, and inevitably they will have a bond fund. Not everybody, but mostly if you wind up in immigration detention, there will be, you will have a bond. And, you know, when we reference that to the American justice system, your bond may be $5,000, and we may look at that, you and I, and say that's not so bad. For a migrant who's just come here and literally has spent everything in their world to come here, $5,000 is completely out of reach. So these bond funds are a community way to raise money for that bond to get this person back out on the street, because it's always preferable to be outside as opposed to in immigration detention. And there are reasons for that. Some of them are very simple. It's easier to meet with your attorney, for example, if you're not incarcerated.
And I assume many of them
and
have
some
families,
of them are more
right?
complex. The speed of the immigration system changes. You have more time to build your case, for example, if you are not in detention. You're not facing constant pressure to sign a voluntary release order. So this is what bond funds do, is they get people out of this corrections environment, detention environment. And what we do is exactly the same thing, only specifically for the queer community. We are larger than the trans community, but we certainly deal with a good number of transgender clients.
Let me ask you another question. I'm kind of curious about basically the first interfaces, the first interactions, the first experience, I guess you would say, for a transgender person who is picked up for being undocumented by the Immigration Service. If they're detained, what's the process? What happens to them initially? How does the justice system in America work for undocumented immigrants who happen to be transgender? Do they have court hearings? Are they allowed legal representation? What does that initial contact and incarceration, I guess, look like?
And this is a very, very complex question for anybody in the immigration system. Understand, first thing to understand is that if you are picked up by Border Patrol, Border Patrol agents have a great amount of discretion, and they have multiple options. They can actually just take you back to the border and drop you. They are still allowed to do that. They can also process you and hold you, at which point you'll be held for 72 hours and then taken back to the border. Unless, of course, you attempt to file for asylum or something like that, in which case you will be sent to detention. They also have the option of filing charges against you. Now, if you've never been in country before, they can charge you with unlawful entry, which is a misdemeanor, and once you have that on your record, or once you have any record that says you've been in the United States before, if you are stopped by Border Patrol, you can actually be charged with unlawful felony reentry. Now, this is a felony, and we, I believe, have probably most of us have heard talk of the government saying that they're not going to pursue non-felony deportations, but this is a process, the act of charging someone with felony reentry, that basically takes non-criminals and turns them into felons, and thus prohibits them from any form of relief, any form of citizenship.
And, you know, I think our justice system across the board has gotten really good at that. We are pretty much an incarceration society these days.
Yes, we are. And I think when you look at immigration, you're running that concept through an amplifier.
Absolutely.
As far as legal representation, yes, they have the absolute right to legal representation. But unlike U.S. citizens, the rulings on the undocumented within the immigration system are they have the right to legal representation at no expense of the government. There is no public defender for immigration hearings. There are some great attorneys that do a lot of pro bono work. There are some great nonprofit organizations that work strictly with immigrant legal rights. We work very closely with the Florence Immigrant Rights and Refugee Project, and that's exactly what they are, is a legal services group that does immigration work and also asylum work.
Interesting. That sounds like a very much needed organization. I'm glad to hear that there are organizations out there that are willing to do pro bono work and work with that community. I would, you know, imagine coming into this country with no language, inability to get a job, in many cases being obviously transgender, you know, the whole compounded discrimination is just, it's going to make it pretty hard for you to be successful in this country. It may be better than what you left behind, the threat of violence, the threat on your life, but certainly it's not going to be what you would hope for. I know, Claire, that you visited transgender immigrants, I think held at the INS Florence detention facility, if I recall. That's a facility that's part of the largest immigration detention system in the world, actually. Tell us about a day in the life of a transgender inmate in these detention facilities. Do they have rules regarding transgender detainees that help offer some level of dignity or protection?
Well, first let me say that I can provide a pretty good snapshot of what the environment is, what the process is. I don't know that I could ever or would ever try to explain a day in the life. This is, I have never been in an immigration detention facility as an inmate, nor will I ever have to be. So there's my little island of privilege.
Yes.
And so I can't fully speak that narrative, but I do want to give some background here. First things first, I want to kind of reframe the terminology, because we love using the word detention. In fact, we have to, because it's illegal to lock people in prison if they haven't committed a crime, but these are prisons. In building design and in the way that they are run, in the protocols, these are medium security prisons. Let's be perfectly clear on that. Detention is not a Holiday Inn. Also, I want to kind of shed some light on that, because most people know about prison is what they've seen in movies and on TV. And if you are in a medium security prison, by and large, you're not locked up in a cell. You are on what they call a run. It's basically a long, narrow room that probably has about a dozen bunks on it. And then, of course, at the end of it, there's the control pod where the guard watches out over you. And I'd like everyone to kind of ponder that for a minute, the thought of being a transgender woman in this confined space with 23 other men, with 23 men. And, you know, there's a good bit of fear in that for a lot of our clients, especially when they're newly incarcerated. It's not a healthy environment.
Oh, it doesn't sound like it. It would be a rather humiliating.
It is, and there are certain risks to it. Plus, you have this initial terror. You could be from, and I'll just pick a country at random, El Salvador, and running from your life. Your life has been threatened there, perhaps even by the police. And you come here, and you wind up in this room with 23 men, some of whom are Salvadoran. And there's a psychological element to that that's really, really dangerous, really negative, especially to those people who are newly incarcerated. In time, people learn to cope. That's kind of the grand story of prison, and it holds true in this environment as well. And it's a really good thing, because another one of the really psychologically terrifying things in immigration detention is if you go to prison for a two-year sentence, in 2 years maximum, you're coming home. If you go to immigration detention, there is no exit date. If you agree to leave the country voluntarily, you could be out of there in a week. If you wish to go through hearings for asylum, you could be there 2, 3, 4 years. And you don't know when you're going to get out.
What's the deal with asylum, Claire? You had mentioned asylum earlier, that the situation would change as far as them possibly being let go by the agents or things like that. How does this asylum process work? Does it work? Is it badly broken? And, you know, do transgender people take advantage of that very frequently?
I would say a majority, vast majority of our clients, and almost all of the transgender clients are, in fact, asylum cases. And I think most of us in the transgender community have been to a transgender day of remembrance with the reading of the names. And if you've looked at that, we see we have our problems in the United States. I'm not making light of that. But you look at the sheer number of names that you're reading from Central and South America, it's very easy to make a case that these are people who with a very real threat to their lives. And that's kind of the basis of asylum, is there is a very real threat to your life. There is a very real threat of political persecution, or there is, this one's tough to get the wording right on. There are cases where there may be life-saving medical treatments that are available here, but not available in your home country. These are the things that make asylum cases.
Yes, okay.
And to be transgender and Central American or South American, you're pretty much going to pass what we call credible threat, which means the U.S. government has decided that, yes, there is a case to be made for asylum, and we're willing to hear it.
I think I remember something about there's a time limit. Is that right? It's a one-year time limit. But I think there's been some evidence that, you know, a lot of trans people don't know about that. And they come here, they're in hiding in the first place. And being transgender means you want to hide a little bit more. You're even more insecure about talking to people about your situation. And so I hear a lot of trans people fail to file on time because they're not aware of this one-year limitation, which I think is ridiculous these days. I think we should do away with that one-year limitation. But has that been your experience? Is that true?
We do see that. We have also seen cases of people who have been here and either been deported or voluntarily left, went back home, and then came back. And that also makes, an asylum case incredibly difficult. But here's where this whole thing rubs very, very wrong. You're correct. People can get them into trouble, and you and I may look at that and say, well, the thing to do is just to come here and apply for asylum immediately. But if you apply for asylum, you've basically turned yourself into the system, and you're going to wind up in that detention center until you post bond.
Right.
Now, in some cases, they will offer immediate bond, but I assure you the poverty levels that we see in the transgender community in the United States amplify when we move into the third world. So even if they give you a bond on day one, affording it is a different matter altogether.
Absolutely.
And so there you have this built-in deterrent where people aren't going to apply for asylum because they don't want to be locked up.
Very
and
much a catch-22, isn't it?
That's infinitely logical.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much a catch-22. We've only got a minute left here, Claire. One more real quick question for you. We could actually talk about this for a long time. We're only really scraping the surface, I think. I've heard a lot about mass hearings, mass deportations. I don't know if that's done without representation or how that works. And obviously, it's not exclusive to the transgender community. I assume that happens to transgender as well as non-transgender undocumented folks. So how does that work? How do these mass deportations without representation happen, or is that just a myth?
Thank you for pointing that out, because that doesn't get a lot of attention. What you're talking about is Operation Streamline, which is a government program that was built, as the name might imply, to streamline the immigration court system. And what it amounts to is anybody who's been charged with unlawful entry or with felony reentry will wind up in streamlined court. And these courts, most people don't realize this, because these courts only exist in the border region. There in Kansas City, you do not have a streamlined court. And they will try up to 70 people at a time. 70 people will go before the judge at once.
Wow.
Up to. And there are attorneys available. The data we're getting from the people who are monitoring this, the court monitors, are that on average, you get 5 to 10 minutes with your attorney, and so the representation you have is really not effective at all. In fact, that study from the University of Arizona I mentioned does go into some detail on that, into the failings of it. But ultimately, we're going to put, I think the record in Tucson was 70 people in 24 minutes.
Wow.
And once you're convicted, now you have this mark on your record, which makes it harder to gain legal entry into the country, as well as harder to gain relief or asylum of any sort. And it also gives you a ticket into the world of immigration corrections, which also exists.
That is just
You're basically going to be hauled off to jail, and then once your sentence is up, you're deported.
You know, I understand that they're undocumented workers, and a lot of people would have the opinion that, you know, they don't have, obviously, constitutional rights because they're not a citizen and whatnot, but they're human beings. It's really, you know, we have to be fair to human beings. It's really hard to understand how a process like that could be construed as being fair, really, by anybody. I want to tell our listeners that you have shared some documentation, Claire, that I will be posting. You spoke of it a little bit earlier. I will be sharing that documentation on our Facebook, KKFI Facebook page later this evening, so everybody will be able to go and look at that documentation and get more information. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to move on to our next interview after a brief break with some music. So, Claire, the organization that you work for, could you one more time say the name of the organization and where people can go to find more information about it?
The organization I work with is Rainbow Defense Fund. And since we kind of throw everything we've got at helping people who are in detention, we really haven't spent any money on web presence. So you can find us at rainbowdefensefund.wordpress.com, just a blog site.
All right. Very good. Claire, thank you very much for joining us today. I wish we had more time. Hopefully you'll come back on the show sometime and talk with us some more. I know you work with some of the most marginalized segments of the trans community, so I would love to have you on to talk some more about the struggles faced by some of the other populations.
Oh, I appreciate that, Sandra, and I appreciate your audience's time today. And the only thing I would ask of the audience is to have a look at this and look at this with an open mind. And remember, we are talking about human beings, as Sandra pointed out.
Absolutely. Very good. Thank you, Claire. We're going to take a really brief music interlude. We're going to get Eli on the phone. We'll be talking with her next. Stay tuned. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Support for KKFI provided by the Sterling Dance Theater, presenting The Prodigal Daughter on Friday and Saturday, October 18th to 19th, 8 p.m. Yardley Hall on the Johnson County Community College campus. This biblical ballet brings the story of the prodigal son into the present to show the struggles of young women leaving home for the real world. Tickets available online at sterlingdance.org. That's sterlingdance.org or at 913-469-4445.
This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Nigeria's anti-gay law unleashes reigns of terror. Putin meets his match in Billie Jean, and Andrew Abaria sings for the underdogs. All that and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
This Way Out airs 2 p.m. Saturdays, right after the 10th voice.
Women should be a priority, respected and upheld in society, given all the proper notoriety, never used or abused by authority figures.
Hi, Eli. Thank you very much for joining us at KKFI. Let me tell the folks on that are listening right now a little bit about you. We've had some technical difficulties earlier today, so we're a couple minutes late calling you. Our apologies about that, Eli. Just so some of my listeners know a little bit more, Eli Ehrlich is the founder of Trans Student Equality Resources. The purpose of that is to help end trans discrimination in education. She's helped thousands of students, families, and others in the trans community by assisting them in creating a safe and supportive school environment. As a publicly out trans youth, she's used her visibility to create understanding and acceptance of trans people everywhere. She's received a great deal of media coverage for her work on helping to pass California's School Success and Opportunity Act, which is what we're going to talk about now. In 2013, last year, just like our last interview guest, Claire, Eli was also nominated and selected one of the trans community's inaugural Trans 100. So we're very excited to have Eli on. Eli, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on.
First, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? I know you were obviously a young trans activist, which I think is absolutely fantastic. Tell us a little bit about your own experience in California. You were a rural transgender youth, which I think was quite a bit different than the big urban areas. What was your transgender youth experience like? And then that'll kind of help direct us into why you got involved, as you did, with AB 1266.
Well, it's certainly a lot different being in a rural community. I came out when I was 8 years old, back in 2003, when I told my class that I was a girl and I just wanted them to treat me as one. But unfortunately, they weren't so receptive, and the students, teachers, and faculty did just the opposite. And so while I was dressing like a girl, I had long hair, and I made it clear about my gender identity, the faculty forbade me from participating in classes and programs with the other girls. And so because there wasn't a law like the School Success and Opportunity Act at the time, the teachers didn't know that I had a right to participate with my own gender. And so I was always forced to be like the girl on the boys team, as my classmates like to tease me about. And the other students, the teachers, the faculty made fun of me in front of classmates and peers. And it was really humiliating at times. And so eventually I stopped participating and my grades and attendance dropped. And I had to refuse to go outside during recess in fear of being physically harassed. Since then, and being allowed to change my records and being embraced by my community when I was 13 or so, I've been able to pass transgender inclusive policies similar to the School Success and Opportunity Act at my own school and several other school districts out here in California. And both the students and districts, myself included, are and have been a lot happier and have been able to succeed because of the policies.
Good for you. We need more people like you who are willing to stand up and... but that's not always easy. It's very difficult. You mentioned the humiliation you were feeling as a student who wasn't being accepted, not only by your peers, but certainly by the adults that were important in that facility in your life at the time. And, you know, that sort of behavior by the adults who have influence over the other kids helped contribute, I'm sure, to the feeling of you know, that it was okay to bully you or not accept you in that school. And so good for you for having the courage and finding, you know, your own courage to be able to come out and help like that. I know there's been a lot. I really wanted to talk about AB 1266 for the reason that what you're doing in California right now is really important across this country. This needs to be implemented in all the schools across this country. But there's a very determined segment of anti-transgender advocates or activists who are trying very hard to get this stopped, and they've in particular picked on a transgender student in Colorado who was doing fine and was well adjusted, and through their manipulation of the media and making false accusations against her, that poor girl is now on suicide watch. The last I heard, hopefully she's doing better. But in any case, we're looking at a very determined group of people who will stop at no expense to stop this important bill that just became active on January 1st. So there's a lot of rumors out there. People are driven by fear. And I want you, with your knowledge, to help us dispel some of these inaccurate rumors that are being put out there in an effort to scare people and have them go to the polls and stop AB 1266. I think in particular one of them that we hear all the time is that basically what this bill does is that any boy or girl can just walk in one day, declare their new gender for that day, and walk into the bathroom or locker room of their choice. That's how this bill is being positioned, and I think it's much more structured and well thought out than that. Can you help us understand a little bit about how that process works? How are students evaluated and approved, you know, to transition basically in school?
Well, the bill is people who are following the bill are encouraged to take this by a case-by-case basis. Of course, a boy couldn't just walk into the girls' room. That's not what this bill is about. That would still be against California policy. There's nothing in this bill that would allow that. These people are feeding on others' ignorance of the trans community, which is really sad to see a group of people, like, attacking and bullying youth for their own political gain.
Yes.
Very sad. This bill just makes sure that all students, including transgender students, have the fair opportunity to participate fully in school in programs appropriate to their gender identity. It allows them to graduate with their classmates because they will feel comfortable participating fully. I know I definitely wish I had a bill like this when I was in school. I would have had a lot easier of a time. I think a lot of the focus is on restrooms, which isn't all that this bill is about. We're also, sports are another huge important thing that many, many trans students aren't able to participate in. Also, it's incredibly important to note that several school districts, including Los Angeles Unified, the second largest school district in this country, along with San Francisco Unified, Oakland Unified, Sacramento Unified, and San Diego also have had similar policies to this, and not one of them has had a single problem for the years that this policy has been in place.
And I think that's important to restate. Not one of them has had documented incidents of problems where transgender students who are allowed to openly express their gender identity have harassed or harmed anyone else. Not one single incident in, we're talking about a decade in some of these school districts. Is that correct?
Yes, almost a decade now on Los Angeles Unified, and they've had so much success with it, and they've been incredibly supportive of the effort for this bill.
And, you know, something else that I think is really important to note that it doesn't make it out there to the public, and again, that is very unfamiliar with the trans community. As you mentioned, these other school districts have had policies in place for many years. They've been quite successful, and there have been no issues. Not only that, I mean, there are existing protections at the federal and state level that have been in place for quite some time. All that AB 1266 is doing is helping inform and guide the school districts around the state on how to implement those successful policies. policies. As you mentioned, Los Angeles and some of the other districts already had them in place. But rural schools, like where you had so much difficulty growing up, had not implemented policies. And all AB 26 is doing, AB 1266, is helping to inform and guide them on the policies that they need to be put in place in order to be compliant with existing laws and regulations. And I think that's very much lost in the conversation as well.
That's absolutely correct. And being from a rural area, I can tell how important it is that this law covers the entire state, because if I hadn't gone to these schools and there wasn't a law like AB 1266, my entire county wouldn't have had any policy for transgender students. And I know I'm not the only trans student in my county, even though it is rural and unpopulated. And this is things related to AB 1266 has affected these other students as well. And so it's really important to just cover all of the schools instead of going by school district to school district, especially for such a straightforward policy like AB 1266 that grants some basic participation rights.
Right. If you if this had been in place in your school when you were growing up, you mentioned that you came out to your classmates at 8 years old and were dressing and had long hair and obviously knew that you were a girl and they were not they weren't going along with that. If this policy had been in place for your school, what are some real changes that what would have been different? Can you give us some concrete examples on what would have been different as far as the administration's approach towards you and possibly administration's approach towards other children?
Well, towards me particularly, I would have been able to participate in sports. I played gymnastics for about 3 years when I was in elementary school, and eventually the teacher split up the teams between boys and girls, and because I hadn't had my records changed, the teacher would have forced me onto the boys' team, which I couldn't do. That would have just been humiliating, so I had to leave it entirely.
That is so sad.
And this is something that is happening all over the country and all over the world. It's also leading to heavy levels of victimization. According to GLSEN's most recent school climate survey on LGBTQ youth, 80% of trans students felt unsafe at school, 59% experienced verbal harassment, and half were victims of physical abuse. These are huge numbers.
They're huge. They're scary.
This is just something that AB 1266 is helping to move down a little bit. Now, this is, of course, just a very, it's a primary policy, and it's a really good step forward. And, of course, there's more to do and a more thorough policy that could be in place, but it's a very great step in the right direction.
It certainly is. The entire trans community, all activist organizations that are concerned about trans youth, gender nonconforming youth, period, watching California very closely and whether or not this group is going to be successful in recalling AB, well, it's not a recall, it basically went into effect, but they want to stop it. They want to basically put this in front of the voters, and I think right now the petitions are being counted, and they have to have a certain number by, I think it's February 24th or something like that, I don't remember exactly, but they have to have a certain number of registered voters confirmed, and if so, then this bill would go back on the ballot, and the California population would have an opportunity to vote on it and possibly stop it at that point. And we all know that it's not the best idea to have the majority voting on the rights of the minority. That's never worked in history, and that's not really what we should be trying to do right now. Tell us what you know, because out here we're in Kansas City, we're in the heartland, out in the center of the Bible Belt. We don't get all the news that you guys are getting right now as far as that recall effort goes. Can you tell us a little bit about the how that recall count kind of went, how the folks, what kind of strategies they were employing, if you know, and if you don't, that's fine, but what were they doing to kind of turn the California populace in their favor and against success for transgender students?
Well, I'd like to add that while they tried to turn the California population against trans students, they haven't succeeded in that. California is a very progressive state. We believe in the rights of all people, regardless of the gender identity. So there's just next to no chance that this bill will be even, or excuse me, the referendum effort will be on the ballot. There, statistically, it's impossible. No referendum has ever achieved such a high validity rate that they would need to actually end up on the ballot. Currently, it's several percent below what they would need. Many of their signatures were found to be false. That is one of their tactics to attempt to get the bill, or excuse me, to get the referendum on the ballot, along with fear-mongering, lying, deceiving the public about trans youth for their own benefit, which is really sad to see them do.
It
has been one of their tactics. But has been very similar to what we saw about Prop 8, and California knows better now.
You know, as an older adult with a child of my own who's actually grown and is an adult now, I can't understand the mentality of another adult, especially other parents who would go through the process that they are of demeaning and misleading and mischaracterizing and deliberately distorting the view and hurting a marginalized population of children rather than standing up and supporting them. So I think it's somewhat shameful in my opinion. That's my opinion, not KKFI's. It's somewhat shameful what's going on over there in that effort to have that bill stopped. Eli, unfortunately, I think we're going to be about out of time, and we're going to have to let you go. I've got to move on to the community calendar, but you're very well spoken. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. I've been really looking forward to having this conversation, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on KKFI with us. I hope you'd be willing to come back and talk with us again. I know your story is quite interesting, and I'd like to have you back again sometime.
That would be great. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much for joining. You have a great day, and California, keep leading the way there. All right.
Thank you.
You bet. We're going to move on to the community calendar. Michael Popa was able to do some updates for us on the community calendar, but Michael is out today. He's spending some time with his partner, having a day off, and enjoying each other's company. So I hope they're having fun today. Let's get started on the community calendar. Tomorrow night, Sunday the 26th at 6:30 p.m. at AIA Kansas City, is an encore performance of Outspoken KC Love and Marriage. This one-night-only encore of the dramatic reading uncovers the diverse experiences of Kansas City's LGBT community, such as a gay immigrant's political asylum in Brookside, a lesbian couple's encounter with the racial politics of separatist women town, and a Parkville trans woman's hilarious observations on her first date. The script was created and edited by Schaefer Nelson. This encore performance is presented by Peace Christian Church, UCC, on behalf of GLAMA and Out Here Now, the Kansas City LGBT Film Festival as well. More information can be found at peacechristianchurch.org. Also tomorrow on, as well as Sunday, February 2nd, so both the 26th and the 2nd, at 1 to 3 p.m. at Like Me Like House, a local high school student wants to hear your coming out story. So for a final school project, he intends to film LGBT teens up to 20 years old, recalling their personal journeys of coming out and how it affected them and their families. Stories from parents are also welcome. If you've always wanted to be on camera, this is possibly your opportunity. More information can be found at likemelighthouse.org. On Thursday, Thursday, January 30th, from 5:30 to 7:30 is the AIDS Walk kickoff celebration at Californo's. For more information, visit AIDS Walk Kansas City on Facebook. And on Monday, February 3rd, the MTF, the Male to Female Support Group, is also at the Lighthouse, holding their monthly meeting at 7 p.m. All male to female trans people of all levels are welcome to attend. For information, check the calendar listing at likemelighthouse.org. And one more I want to tell you about. On Friday, February 7th, the Millennial League is transforming the Madrid Theater into Rio with bright colors. Huge headdresses, feathers, exotic, over-the-top fabulousness. For more information, You can find it at vowvow.mlkc.org. I would like to welcome or thank everybody for joining us today on Trans Talk, this week's edition of the 10th Voice. Many thanks to our special guests today, Claire Swinford and Eli Ehrlich. And, of course, thank you very much for Mark filling in place of Linda. Thank you very much. Be sure to tune into the 10th Voice every Saturday. You can always send an email with your thoughts and suggestions to the 10thvoice at gmail.com. Next up, stay tuned for This Way Out, followed by Wings, and then Every Woman, hosted by Sharon Lockhart. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI.